Welcome to Read Between the Covers. Today, we're joined by Edmund, a doctoral candidate in philosophy and a researcher at the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg. A few weeks ago, Edmund published a compelling opinion piece in the Mail and Guardian that challenges us to think deeply about the power of names and identity in post-colonial Africa. In the wake of independence, many African nations have undergone profound transformations, including the reclamation of their pre-colonial names. These renamings represent more than mere changes in nomenclature. They're powerful assertions of identity and self-determination. Yet, as Edmund succinctly points out, one significant name remains largely unchallenged: that of the continent itself. Today, we'll explore this fascinating intersection of naming, power, and identity, and discuss why the conversation about Africa's name might be crucial for its future development. Edmund, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mfundo, and thank you very much for inviting me to this amazing show of yours.
Oh, thank you.
I am happy to be here, and I'm happy to also speak to your amazing audience. And I hope that your audience enjoy the conversation that we're going to have today.
Definitely, definitely. You are, in fact, my first guest on the show, so I'm very excited for this conversation, and yeah.
That's exciting, I saw. I mean, I think I'm proud of that now.
it's definitely something.
I'm just thinking about the show in the next couple of months and couple of years. I'd be so proud to say that at least I've begun the show with you.
Oh, wow. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. So I'd love for our listeners to get to know you better. Could you just tell us about your academic journey and what drove you to examine this particular aspect of colonial African identity?
That's very interesting. So I come from a very philosophical tradition. Basically, I did my undergrad in philosophy, honors in philosophy. I was looking at some jurisprudence, at least from an African perspective, looking at the concept of law. And then in my master's, I delved into artificial intelligence, where I was looking at regulations and ethics. But for the most part, I was very interested in the notion of technology transfer and the implication of technology transfer in the sub-Sahel. And I was using like two compelling examples of technologies that are actually changing our identity, our value systems, and all of that. Technologies like sex robots and technologies like facial recognition technology. And so that really put me into technology such that at least technology of the current social milieu, such that in my PhD, I decided to delve deep into it. Now, I was looking at policies that are regulating the designs of technology within the designs and use of technologies within the medical space. And then I realized that there is a profound value system that is underrepresented but it has some kind of significance, or it has some kind of significant impetus, or it has the pedigree to be regarded as the ethical tradition, which is the African relational ethics. So I was looking at how African relational ethics, the value of the relational values within the sub-Sahara, can contribute to human-centered designs of technology. Especially within the medical space and public health. So with that idea, or at least from that scholarship and that perspective of looking at the world, I started engaging in African concept, especially its underrepresentedness and all of that. And because I'm African, I started thinking of how at least African value system can contribute to global discourse in AI, in machine learning, in data ethics, in medicine, and public health. But then this particular issue that I wrote in the Mail on Guardian, it came as a result of some research that I was doing. So I was trying to do what we call revise and resubmit. So revise and resubmit is when you send a paper to a journal article and then it goes out for peer reviews and then the reviewers give you their corrections and all of that. And then the editor of the journal says, okay, you know, revise and resubmit. So some of the reviewers, I think one of the reviewers pointed me to a fascinating literature that was written by an African philosopher, Professor Mugabe, Bernard Mugabe, and was a South African scholar. And then I started Ramose, although whatever I was reading from Ramose didn't fit into this article, but at the same time, it created a different niche for me to looking at the concept of Africa, the concept Africa. So he was discussing how the name came into perspective, how it came into being, what it meant, and all of that. And then I said to myself, how come I didn't know this all along? So if I didn't know this, it means that this idea, it means that this discourse has not been pushed forward as the narrative, at least in our schools and in our educational system. And that also led me to engaging with this conversation and arguing for this to be brought into public debate or public scrutiny. We must engage with the concept Africa, at least as Africans, to see if we want to keep the name, but at least we must know what it means. You know, because I didn't know what it meant up till now, up till at least 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago when I published this or when I got into this article. I didn't know what the name Africa represents. But I always go about saying I'm African. I'm African. What does that even
mean? What does that mean? What does that entail?
Exactly. So that was what propelled me to engaging with this conversation and now to engaging with conversations that are related to this.
Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. And you bring up such an important point to say that, you know, we go around calling ourselves Africans, you know, and we say that we belong to the continent of Africa, but very seldomly do we scrutinize the etymology of the name and where it comes from and what it means. And I think this is such a brilliant conversation to have.
Exactly. You know, and it's like you've pointed out, we just don't know the etymology of it. And I think we just take it for granted. It just goes without saying that I'm an African, and that's it. We're supposed to know that I'm an African. But then I realized that it goes beyond that. It goes beyond etymology. It also has to do with something about identity. At least there is a correlation between names and identity. So when I say to someone that I am Edmund, I am Edmund. Sometimes someone asks, the question is always often raised, what does Edmund mean? And then I'm going to say, this is what Edmund means. And it's asking questions like, do you represent that name when you go on? Or my middle name, which is my favorite name. And this was also what propelled me. So I realized that when someone calls my middle name, which is supposed to be their first name because it's my traditional name, which is Terrain, when someone pronounces that name correctly, it brings a certain kind of profound joy. And other than, like, when someone calls me Edmund, I'm like, okay, it's just a name. But when you call me Terrain, it's for some reason, it brings out that identity in me. And that was where I went into a deeper reflection to then trying to ask the question, does that ring a bell? Like when I'm called an African, does it really spur any feelings of confidence or feelings of belonging? You know, and I realized that, okay, actually there is a conversation where they would need to engage with.
Wow. Fascinating. Okay, let's delve in, because you said that it's beyond etymology. It goes to identity as well. So I think we're going to speak about related concepts to this. And, you know, the power of naming in colonial contexts extended far beyond mere designation, right? It represented an exercise of authority and epistemic control. And we know that European colonizers systematically renamed both territories and people as part of their colonial project. Now, this naming practice parallels almost how slave owners would rename their captives to assert some kind of psychological dominance and erase their previous identities. Here's that word again, identity. So your article suggests that colonial naming represents a form of epistemic violence. And if we accept this premise, could maintaining the name Africa actually serve as a powerful reminder of historical injustices, making it harder to forget or minimize colonial impact? So in other words, might there be value in keeping the scar visible? I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a very important question that you're asking. So to be very direct, I would say yes, it does. It does remind us of this, not just epistemic violence, but metaphysical violence. And by metaphysical violence, I mean, is the violence to being. So philosophically, when we look at the concept of metaphysics, we want to look at being, a being qua being. So a being is that which exists, right? So there is a violence that is perpetrated to our being, the being qua being, the human being, the human being is within this spatial temporal society called, for lack of a better word, Africa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, when we look at a child, let me use the analogy of a child. The reason why we name a child, let's say if I call a child, I give birth to a child and I say, your name is John. Of course, the child cannot object to that because the child does not even have some of the capacity and the resources that would afford them the authority and power to say, no, I detest God name, right?
That's not my name.
For some reason, the child goes about carrying that name. And I think you, while asking the question, you made a point about slavery. Let's say, for instance, if we want to go back into the era of slavery, you realize that there was a certain form of renaming, which was a thing of ownership. So when a slave owner gets slaves, the slave owner renames the slave. The reason for that is just to mark or to create a stamp of ownership. And it's a thing, even when we want to go into propriety laws, for instance, when I have something, right, and I name a thing, right, I have with the intellectual property to own the propriety rights to that thing. So that is exactly what is going on. There is a certain kind of propriety right that is given to that which name. So the name are over the name, you know. So, and for me, it's to be systemic, but at the same time, it's a form of metaphysical violence. There's that relationship between the owned and the owner, the named and the namee, or the namer and the namee per se. It might appear to be subtle, but it is there. And the worst part of this subtle effect is that it has some kind of deep implication on the being. That is the being qua Africa, or African rather, or the being qua Black, or the being qua Indigenous, you know. And for me, that's a form of violence.
Wow. Okay. So us continuing to carry this name, in essence, perpetuates or consolidates the control that was imposed upon us by virtue or by means of us being named, you know, by this term Africa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And again, and I think maybe the point of departure to even begin from the meaning of the name and how the name came about. The name came about as a result of an expression, right? For all that is worth, of course, this is debatable, but from my perspective, we're just a European expression of a certain kind of feeling, the feeling of the environment in which it doesn't even just relate to the entirety, the continent in its entirety, but again, it's a certain form of expression. Like, and I know maybe I might be way further, maybe you might ask this question at some point, but again, mm-hmm. it's like, I think the analogy that we could use would be some kind of the Judeo-Christian creation narrative. Remember in the book of Genesis, when Adam wakes up and sees a woman in front of him that God has created. What did Adam say? Adam said, "This is like it was like the woman became an expression of Adam." Adam was like, "You are now woman, you know, because you were made out of me." But there are different forms of interpretation to this anthropological narrative. But again, there was a certain form of awe. Like, and there was a certain form of ownership that went on there within that dialogue. No matter how theologians would want to put it, but if we're being honest with ourselves, there was a certain kind of ownership that was portrayed there.
I like how you linked it to that Judeo-Christian narrative, because it calls into question some of the contextual frameworks that we use to think about decolonization, in this particular instance, the changing of Africa's name. So I think that leads well to my next question, because there seems to be some tension between Western individualistic frameworks and African communal philosophies, which, you know, represents a crucial fault line in this discussion of identity. Because according to various research, pre-colonial African societies operated with some kind of social and political philosophies centered on the universal recognition of human worth. And this stands somehow in contrast to Western psychological models like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which prioritize individual self-actualization. The concept, for example, of Ubuntu, often translated as "I am because we are," exemplifies this African philosophical approach where personhood is inherently tied to community. So in your article, in your opinion piece, you reference Maslow's hierarchy of needs in relation to identity. However, could one argue that collective identity formation precedes individual self-actualization in an African context? So how does this tension between individual and collective identity play into this naming discourse?
Interesting question. Before I answer that question, I need to clarify something. The philosopher in me is very, very interested in clarifying something. In philosophy, there's something that we call essentialism. So essentialism is the idea that this belongs on, is the idea that an idea belongs to, let's say, it's of essence to a particular group in such a way that, or an idea is in essence to a particular object or a particular space in such a way that it is not the same in other places.
Okay.
And then people bring up this idea of relativism and all of that. But, and I think, for the sake of your listeners, right, what I want to do is that the idea, whatever, how I'm going to answer this should not be interpreted as a form of essentialism. I am not going to say that Africa is communal while European and the global north, and by global north, I want to look at people that share some form of identity, Europe, America, that they're individualist. But because colonialism is in the West, the same way individualism is also in sub-Saharan Africa, especially in our continent. Yeah. But again, there is something that is called geographical labeling. So we are looking at the dominance idea. So the dominant idea within sub-Saharan Africa is that we are collectivist people. We also recognize the individual, but we recognize the individual in respect to the community. So how does the individual service the community? Of course, the individual is respected, but the individual is respected as long as the individual denotes the value of the collective. And whereas in the global north, in dominant theories in the global north, it is the individual or individual. But it's the individual, it's the individual. So for instance, we want to go to philosophers like Immanuel Kant, that would look at the concept of autonomy and all of that. But now in sub-Saharan Africa, it is the individuals or community, individual as CEs to the community. So when we are looking at the Maslow needs hierarchy or hierarchy of needs, we want to look at least within the context of sub-Saharan Africa, we want to look at the individual invested to the community. What are the needs of the individual? The needs of the individual are those that are of beneficial to the community and vice versa. And the community's need is those that also service the individuals that are in or that are part of the parcel of the community. And what this means is that within the continent, when the individual thinks, in such a way, or when the individual ought to think, the individual ought to think in such a way that their thinking is that which contributes to the collective growth of the community and those around the individual. So when we look at Maslow needs of hierarchy, as Africans, we must ensure that our needs are those that are in service to the broader community. Such that our identity formation should be the identity that is related to the identity of others. So, for instance, philosophers like Thaddeus Mann, an African philosopher of American origin, would say that in Africa, an individual thinks in two ways: identity and solidarity. Such that I share the same identity as the next person, and I'm supposed to stand in solidarity as the next person. I need to understand what it means to be the other person. So my identity, when I portray my identity, it must not conflict with the identity of other people, because we share similar identity. We look at the world not in a similar way, not in a myth of unanimity, but at least we look at the world in relation to how it is beneficial to the person next to us.
Wow. That's some interesting clarity. And I love the fact that you elucidate that point quite clearly, because you're essentially stating that we're not painting in broad strokes. We look at our relation to society, particularly from an African context, individually, but in service of the entire collective. Stay tuned for more Read Between the Covers after this break. So, let's look at the elephant in the room, colonialism. The Berlin Conference in 1884, 1885 marked a really critical moment when European powers arbitrarily divided the continent, disregarding the existing cultural and political boundaries. The scramble for Africa resulted in European powers colonizing close to 98% of the continent, with only Ethiopia and Liberia remaining independent. The very concept of Africa as a single continental entity with defined borders is itself a product of this colonial cartography. And this leads me to think about whether efforts to rename the continent might inadvertently legitimize these artificially imposed boundaries. So I say all of this to point out that the concept of a continental identity itself could be seen as a European construct, and in proposing to rename the continent, are we perhaps inadvertently reinforcing the colonial boundary drawing exercise that created artificial divisions across indigenous territories and people?
I think that's also very interesting. But I would like to come from a different perspective, saying that renaming the continent is also a political statement, right? It is okay. A political statement in the context that we come from an oppressive regime. We come from an oppressive form of existence. You know, there is violence to our existence. And this violence is something that came up from the Berlin Conference, before the Berlin Conference, and all of that. And the concept, the name Africa again, in as much as when the name Africa was first mentioned, it was not as a result of the relationship that happened in the Berlin Conference, but it's something that happened during the Roman era and even prior to that, of course, with Northern Africa, or the place that is called Northern Africa now, relating very well to Europe. So Northern Africa at the time was seen as an aspect of Europe. It was a southern aspect of, it was a southern expansion of Europe. But then the name Africa spread across due to colonial transformation and due to colonial, of course, colonial movement. And this happened like in the Berlin Conference and the rest. So renaming the continent itself, or even if we're not renaming the continent, but saying that let's say we put it into a debate and say, okay, no, we want to keep the name. But at least now we're keeping the name because we feel like we want to keep the name, not as a result of an imposition. Because right now we are carrying the name as a form of imposition because we've not even engaged with the concept in our parliament, or at least in the African Union, or at least brought it up into public scrutiny. We've not. And I think I read an article, and one of the articles that I cited in the opinion piece is what? It's the political power of naming. So when we rename, we're making a political statement of autonomy, a political statement of sovereignty, a political statement of reclaiming identity. And it doesn't matter what the name is, but we're making a statement. And I think it's the same kind of statement that was happening in the renaming that happened in South Africa. The renaming of Port Elizabeth to Alberta, also the renaming of certain roads in Pretoria, for instance. Those were political statements that were made. It might sound as if they're very insignificant. No, they carry very significant implications. So let's say, for instance, let me use an example. Right from when we had colonial encounter with Europe, let's say the Europeans came to our continent. Let us look at South Africa, for instance. We have, in South Africa, of course, we would say that we are blessed that we have these different groups in South Africa, whites, Indians, and the rest. But just to tell you the significance of name, how many white South Africans go with the name Thabo?
Not a lot.
How many white South Africans go with the name Tlengwa or Tembi or
Mfundo?
Exactly. How many Indians go with that name? But then, how many Africans go with the name Henry, go with the name Edwin, go with the name Fidelis,
John,
and all of that, John, and all of that? Are you trying to tell me that for about 400 years that we've had white presence in South Africa, they've not gotten to the point where they can take the names, the African name? No, it's because they are trying to maintain a certain form of identity. And that's why you will hear names like John, you will hear names like daughter, you will hear names like, you know, because they are trying to maintain a certain form of identity. So you could see the very subtle power that, so when we start changing names, there is a certain kind of political state, and our identity is it's something that is also political as well. So, and that is where the fact that when we make these changes to our identity, especially beginning from names, we're not just replicating colonial mentality, but we're moving away from this colonial mentality to making a bold statement of sovereignty and autonomy and all of that. At least that is where I am coming from, and that is where my thinking is coming from.
Okay. I understand your perspective, and I really appreciate it. And I like how you related it to the examples of the names that we ourselves carry and how we're somehow, in many instances, tethered to those white, quote-unquote, names. And you said something very interesting, right? In terms of renaming Africa, you said the name doesn't really matter. It's about the political statement that we're making by renaming our continent. And this goes to a question that I wanted to ask about the linguistic landscape of Africa, which obviously presents a rich tapestry of indigenous names and designations for regions and people. So in your research into pre-colonial naming systems, have you found evidence of how different African people historically refer to the continent or their regions? So we often see claims online about names like Al-Kebulon being the original name for Africa, but the historical record seems less clear. What has your research revealed about the indigenous names for this continent?
Oh, first of all, I don't think there would be a historical name that is tantamount to Africa. And the reason for that is because, remember, the continent Africa is an amalgamation of different regions. Let's say people in the sub-Sahel, let's say in Nigeria, for instance, even in Nigeria, in what is called Nigeria, there were the Benin, we had the Benin Kingdom. So it was about kingdoms, right? So we didn't have this amalgamated continent. So as a result of that, there wouldn't be a name that would suffice. That would say that this was a representation of the continent. So whatever anthropological investigation that we go back in the past would not really be so epistemically valid, I'd like to put it like that. So, but we can just look at the continent, at least from a regional perspective, where we can say, okay, certain places were called Bantu, certain places were called Akan, certain places were called the Benin Kingdom, certain places were called the Yoruba, the Oduduwa Kingdom, you know, things like that. Those things, those are the kinds of concepts, naming concepts that would suffice.
Interesting, because it links back to the previous point that we made about the colonial boundaries that were drawn and this idea of Africa as an amalgamation of all these different kingdoms, as you say, as one single entity. And you're basically saying that didn't exist. That's a concept that was created or imposed upon us. So there wouldn't necessarily be a name that was used historically to describe the entire continent.
Exactly.
Okay, so now let's talk about this issue of renaming, right? Because let's say we rename the continent. Given that Africa has so many languages, how do we address the risk of a new official name potentially marginalizing existing indigenous terms? So could a formal renaming paradoxically lead to a loss of linguistic diversity in how the continent is referenced?
I wouldn't say it depends on our approach to renaming, right? I wouldn't say that it's going to lead into the extinction of certain kinds of diversity. This diversity will still be there. But let us look at the continent, for instance. Again, it ties to my claim that It's about making political statements. It's not even about just the name, but it's about making political statements. So, for instance, I mean, we've been engaging in the concept of democracy. We've been voting for the most part. And in Africa, at least philosophically, or some philosophers like people like Bernard Mazzolino would want to trace the form of the political environment of Africa to be one that was embedded in what he calls consensus democracy, where we sit on a tree and debate on issues until we come to into a consensus, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, we can still approach the naming or renaming of the continent from a very consensus democratic paradigm, where, I mean, we could bring different names to parliament. And by parliament, I mean the African Union. Mm-hmm. We can just engage in conversations and we put it into a vote, whereby there will be some kind of equal opportunity for us to pick up something. And I don't think, as long as there is no bias in doing that, I don't think it will then lead into people, certain people. Of course, certain people would feel like, I wish it was fast, but at least the process was fair. And using a fair process would lead to something that would be appreciable, you know? And I think that's the idea. That is a recommendation that I would make to the African Union to approach it this way. And also, but we could also still keep our diversity. It also boils down to the issue of language as well. We've been having the problem of language for a long time. I mean, we have very beautiful languages in the continent. We have Kiswahili, we have Zulu, we have Pedi, we have all of these languages. Exactly, a plethora of languages. We could also use a consensus democratic paradigm as well to formulate a continental language of communication. I'm sure. But at the same time, we can still maintain a subtle difference in some kind of other languages. But at least we could have these continental languages that would be taught in schools, that would aid communication, that such that when I travel from here to Ghana, in as much as there are certain kinds of languages in Ghana, there are kind people and all of that. But at the same time, I can still communicate, because we've had some kind of consensus language that we've all agreed on to be some kind of continental language while maintaining our unique identity. Of course, I don't want us into going into what a philosopher like, who's a friend, a philosopher like Samuel Shegun, which we'll call the myth of unanimity, where we have people who think that we have this unanimous identity. No, but again, we can still have some kind of identity that we can all relate to.
Powerful. I think that you actually gave us a really great recommendation in terms of how this process can be carried out, because you spoke about some kind of public consultation process that would essentially use a democratic model to come to some kind of decision on what Africa's name should be. We'll be back with more Read Between the Covers after this break. The challenge of researching pre-colonial names and naming systems is complicated by what Montclair describes as the colonialists' disastrous invasion of the continent. Much of the written historical records comes from colonial sources, creating a methodological challenge for researchers attempting to reconstruct pre-colonial naming practices. Now, traditional African societies relied heavily on oral traditions and non-written forms of historical preservation, which were often overlooked or deliberately suppressed by colonial record keeping. What methodological challenges have you encountered in researching pre-colonial names and naming systems, and how do we navigate the relative scarcity of written historical records while avoiding over-reliance on colonial sources?
That's a very interesting question. And also, I think I need to also make like a disclaimer. the best part of being a philosopher is being able to state things that you also don't know at the moment. So at the time, I would also want to make a disclaimer that I am not an expert in this archaeological epistemic gymnastics I don't have like deep expertise. It was just something that I came across, and as a philosopher that I am, who is just very interested in uncovering of knowing and the process of knowing, that's why I've been engaging in that. So I don't really have some kind of archaeological and anthropological expertise in this area. But at least from a very critical perspective and from a very methodological perspective, at least on the basis of critical thinking, I'd like to think that some of the problems that I face, the issues of using colonial lens in uncovering traditional processes, in a sense that of looking at of looking at pre-colonial discourses from a colonial lens. It's something that some philosophers have called the narrative of return. Like, we want to return back to the pre-colonial, but there is a certain kind of violence that took place such that the pre-colonial cannot be returned to, at least in its pristine nature. But at the same time, I'd like to also think that we can recreate this by, of course, it's a difficult thing, but I mean, in the process of naming it, for instance, like when I listen to the name Mfundo, yeah, it doesn't ring any colonial interpretation to me.
Not at all.
Of course, it will have some kind of translational challenges because now we are English speakers or we use colonial languages, and according to how philosophers like Wittgenstein would say, language controls most of our thinking. We think on the basis of language. And at the moment, we think from a very colonial language, so at least we have colonial ideas. When I'm thinking from the... You see that thing where you're speaking your native language, right?
Yeah.
You realize that it makes so much sense to you. But the moment you want to translate it to English, there's lost in translation that happens.
Indeed.
And then you would see that you don't relate to an idea the way you would relate to that idea when you engage with that idea from your mother tongue. It's the same thing as what the Chinese society is doing. In China, physics is taught
Is it Mandarin?
In Mandarin, yes. Things like that, and we see that, and that's why, without bias or anything, are we seeing the remarkable things that people are doing in China? Kids are doing in China. They are revolutionizing education completely. That is a power of language and the power of identity. They are able to recognize their identity embedded in their language. Of course, in Africa, we have this fracture that is going on, of course, because it's due to the different languages. But at the same time, we can start somewhere, you know. It will be difficult, but yeah. But sometimes I'd like to think that sometimes methodologically, we have to figure it out. But we have to, especially from the premise of language. Because language is that which controls most of our thinking. The moment we get it wrong from the perspective of language, we get it wrong from different perspectives as well.
Wow. You know, I was just sitting listening to the point that you're making, and it really has me thinking a lot about this concept that you bring up about language and how it shapes our thinking, and in many ways, for instance, like me, the medium that I usually use to communicate and think is English. So therefore, my thinking is almost dictated or embedded in that sort of practice. And
you can school me better because I know you're an expert in communication. I think you have expertise in strategic communication. You should know better what language does in terms of communication. and all of that. So yeah, I think you're an expert here. You know better.
Well, again, as you said, philosophers like to put disclaimers. I'm no philosopher. That's the first disclaimer. Second disclaimer, I'm not an expert, but I think that you bring up such an important point. And perhaps this is something that I need to reflect upon more deeply and do more research to look at, you know, the impact of language and how that impacts how we receive something, how we convey something. So very important points that you bring up that I need to look into. Let's look at theoretical frameworks, right? There are different schools of decolonial thought, and they offer varying perspectives on the importance and the approach to continental renaming. For instance, Nkrumah's conscientism seeks to harmonize, you know, traditional African values with post-colonial realities. Ngugi wa Thiong'o emphasizes linguistic decolonization, and Achille Mbembe focuses on psychological and institutional structures. Now, each of these approaches suggest different priorities in addressing colonial legacy. So where do you position your argument within these varying theoretical frameworks as it pertains to addressing these colonial legacies?
I'd like to think that it falls very well with especially from the preceding question that you asked on language. At least when we're talking about language, we want to look at what Thiong'o, Mbungi would be like a very would provide us with that kind of theoretical framework. But at the same time, I actually Mbembe as well. The whole thing about mental decolonization, because it's this thing where, do you know that there are certain Africans that when you call them by their traditional African name, they get so upset. It sounds so disgusting to them.
Really?
Exactly. Like, let me not lie. You see, this is me dragging Nigerian. Unfortunately, I'm a Nigerian, so I won't be canceled. Nigerians love colonial names. Like, it's that thing where somebody that is called Chioma, for instance, will want to look for a way of making the name sound so English to them, you know? Like, for instance, so I remember when I was growing up, my name used to be Teren. Everyone called me Teren at home. But for some reason, when I discovered that, I was also Edmund. I had to include Edmund to my name, and people started calling me Edmund until I grew old, and I was like, why would I be using the name Edmund? But at the time, it sounded very nice to me. And I was like, Terem sounds very local. I want to be very foreign. You know what I mean? And then it also is. And now I cringe when someone does not even pronounce my name correctly. Especially that's why I don't even give people the name Terem. Because the moment they call me, they use some kind of colonial accent, English, British accent to call me. It cringes me. I cringe, let me not lie. Yeah. So you see, so there is a certain kind of mental decolonization that is also supposed to take place here. Because at the moment, a lot of people would also want to think that there is no necessity for us to change the name Africa. For them, they will say that, oh no, let's look at economic issues. Let's look at social issues. At least now we're moving into technological era. Let us look at how to decentralize technology and all of that. You know, things like that. But they don't know the implication of what the name is to the identity to begin with. Of course, I'm very sympathetic to the economic issues in Africa. But at the same time, and that is why I am coming from a perspective that it's not just about the naming. It's the political statement that we are making. And that political statement is what is going to then drive other forms of progress. And again, I mean, Socrates would say something like knowing thyself. How do you even progress when you don't know thyself? How do you even progress when you're not even reflective of your identity, when you have identity crisis? you don't get progress in identity crisis. You don't. You're not progressive when you have identity violence. What are you progressive about? What are you changing? Where are you coming from? Where are you going to? Where you are at? You know, it's not about trying to have multinational companies in that you don't even know the economic, whatever economic processes that are involved. It's not about having electric cars and thinking that is progress. When you don't have identity progress, you would never have any kind of progress. And that is why I always reference China. China is doing so well to develop its identity, its cultural identity. Of course, one would say that there is some form of homogeneity that is in China at the moment. Of course, yeah, but it doesn't mean that we cannot also learn despite that diversity. There are certain aspects that we converge. Why can't we work from the point of convergence, you know? So I think some kind of mental decolonization. I don't like using the word decolonization. Some kind of mental decentralization needs to take place. And Osko, like, for instance, when we are looking at, from the perspective of Kwame Nkrumah, I did Kwame Nkrumah's conscientism in my third year when I was doing African philosophy. I was taught by my African philosopher lecturer then, Matulino, Bernard Matulino. And what Nkrumah was doing in conscientism was that Nkrumah was coming from the perspective that he doesn't understand why we would want to think that a certain group of people are better than another group of people. Because at the end of the day, everything that exists in the world comes from a very material perspective. And materialism does not have superiority. So matter is matter, you know? Whatever perspective that you're coming from, you're made out of matter. And as a result of that, the ideas that elucidate from that does not really make you superior because you still matter anyways. But then Nkrumah conscientism would be something that is more of some kind of political decolonization, especially when it comes to geopolitics in the global realm, and also when it comes to international relations and all of that. I mean, why should the IMF have more interest rate for Africans and lower interest rates for the European? Are we not all made out of the same matter and all of that? Or this matter. Idea that Africans are not epistemically buoyant. What is that? We all matter at the end of the day, you know? So that's where Nkrumah will come from. But yeah, I think we need more of this form of rethinking. That is the most difficult part, you know? It is the most difficult part because currently we want to think that that which is European is better than that which is African and indigenous. Again, that's because of that. It's a mental problem, more of some kind of material problem.
Does that stem from all the years of conditioning? Could we attribute that to colonialism? Because what stood out is the practical case study that you gave, saying that Nigerians, these are your words, not mine, so don't cancel me, you know, prefer to use those colonial names as opposed to their own indigenous names. Why do you think that we still have that framework as Africans? Why hasn't there been a psychological or a significant psychological shift which would lead to us reclaiming our identity and understanding where we come from and who we are?
Again, you need to know, you need to understand that colonialism has not even ended. Of course, now we are in a new colonialist era, technological colonialism era, and I think I coined the concept of technological colonialism in my master's research to mean value colonialism through technology. Let us look at the idea of cell phones, for instance. A cell phone is not just It's not just a tool. It's not just a technology that is value neutral. It comes with a particular forms of communication that is embedded in a particular culture. For instance, Mfundo is somewhere, I don't even know where you are at, and I am here at Melrose Ag. I could be sitting next to you and having a proper conversation where you're going to see every aspect of me, the way I'm reacting to these questions, my smiles in answering this question, my frustrations in answering these questions, and all of that. But no, we have a medium of communication now that puts you as an individual that is sitting elsewhere, and I as an individual that is sitting elsewhere, and just trying to relate, where we could be sitting and enjoying each other's company, physical presence. But that looks like it is not a form of colonial thinking.
Colonialism.
Let us look at the way we dress, for instance. Like people, like when you wear your traditional attires, people like, I don't, you don't look formal. What's the concept of formal? The concept of formal is you putting on a suit. So formal is synonymous to wearing a suit, and a suit is synonymous, or a suit is a form of dressing that comes from a particular context, you know. But again, we don't see the implication of that to how we think about the world, how we visualize the world, and how we see the world. You know, all of these things have some kind of implications and consequences. And that is why you see that this colonial narrative will continue to proliferate and will be continue to be in a very ubiquity way. We have this subtle... subtle markers of colonial thinking that we don't even realize we still have at the moment, per se. And people will call it progress. They will call it, we are a progressive society. Are we really a progressive society? Progressive according to which...
What standard?
You know, progressive according to a European... American standard, speaking English with certain kinds of accent in such a way that it was so bad in Nigeria. Like, I find it difficult to even speak my native language, because in Nigeria you have to speak English as a form of way of communicating, such that the moment you speak the native language, you're being punished. So you're being punished for portraying the identity that is deeply yours, you know. So those are subtle forms of the continuation of this violence that we don't even realize, you know. What about the way we teach in schools, classroom? A classroom kind of teaching is not something that is deeply indigenous, at least research has pointed that out. But again, we still continue with that. We still continue with video conferencing. COVID came and it even drew us even further apart again from this traditional relationship or relationship. I even published an article, a journal article, where I was rethinking the concept of work. What is the concept of collegial relationship in a place of work? We've lost that. The worker is now someone that is very, very individualist, that can work from anywhere. The relationship that happened in the workplace. What about me coming to my colleague and having a cup of coffee in a corridor and telling my colleague how my day was? What about that part? What about that relationality? It's not there. But again, we don't understand all of that. We've lost that. And so, which means we are deeply and deeply appreciating a certain form of standard as the standard, as opposed to, you know, that which we already know.
There's a lot that we need to rethink, because I love how you open the aperture or the lens of neocolonialism to include not just economics and politics, but the very subtle day-to-day things that we do that are embedded in how we relate to each other. So, very interesting. Let's think about the implications of this conversation for the future generation, young people listening to this. There is obviously this urgent need for conscientization of Africans about their heritage. And I firmly believe that the impact of colonial naming continues to influence how younger generations understand and relate to their cultural heritage, which raises questions about the long-term psychological and social effects of colonial naming practices. So what impact do you think this conversation could have on a younger generation's understanding of their heritage and identity?
Systemic agency, epistemic awareness, at least young generations will know. You know, there are lots of people that go about not even knowing their identity because now we have identity crisis due to certain realities that we find ourselves. Technology transfer, digital spaces, and all of that. So there's this crisis that is going on. But I think young people deserve to be taught this in schools. They deserve to engage in this, or at least to be made aware of these conversations. I mean, I only got to know about this conversation when I'm almost leaving varsity as a postgrad.
Imagine. After so many years of going through the schooling system, you finally learn something at the end.
I imagine. In primary school, they were telling me things like, let's say it was River Niger in Nigeria was named by Mungo Park. Like, of course, then you didn't know. But I mean, what about the indigenous people that were living there? Didn't they have a name for that river?
Prior to being named by an external entity.
Exactly. So it was when Mungo Park came, he just went and discovered a river. And in fact, the people that were living there didn't even know that that was a river. Didn't know that that was a stream of water. So, you know, so things like these are things that are supposed to be engaged with. We must change our curriculum, you know. We must change how we teach. And if you see most of these countries, European countries, you see that they're very, very, they have a strong position on what happens in their schooling system. And China is also taking that strong position. It's just here in our own continent that we are not taking those kind of strong positions as well. And that's because we don't even have some agency to do that, or that's how it appears. So we are mostly learning about European histories than we learn about African history or the history of the indigenous people. Yeah. Those are the things that we're supposed to be teaching our younger generations. Because remember, let us even look at what is happening in South Africa. To tell you how history is important and to tell you how identity is important. Mm-hmm. What is happening in Orania, for instance? There is a group of Afrikaners that have decided to go form a society of their own. Mm-hmm. I don't want to even delve into the constitutional implications of that, or the political implications of that, at least as it appears to histories of oppression and colonialism in the past, of why a certain group of people would think that it's very necessary for them to maintain a certain form of identity in a country that, at least from the perspective that we are at now, we can say that it's not technically theirs. That is arguable. But again, that's not the point. The point is a group of Afrikaners have decided to create a society where they want to maintain their values, they want to maintain their language, they want to maintain their identity. They want to maintain certain things that speaks about the Afrikaner society. That is to tell you the importance of that. And they have a schooling system. They have a political system.
That's their own.
That is their own. As Africans, instead of us fighting and saying, why would you want to create a society of your own in a democratic South Africa? We should be thinking about their point of departure, what is influencing that thinking? And then we shouldn't just take these things for granted. That's the thing, we take these things for granted. And again, that's because of our colonial mentality as well. So younger generation, they are building a future where they maintain a certain form of tradition. And traditions can only be maintained when the younger generations are embedded in that tradition. So when the younger generation, when people that are Black or people that are indigenously African, or again, although we're problematizing the name African, the indigenous people, the Bantu people, if they don't have a future generation that respects, acknowledges, and take pride in their tradition, of course, we're not going to have anything African or anything indigenous mm-hmm. Bantu in the next couple of years. That would be lost.
It would be.
Yeah. So that is exactly what we need to learn.
Wow. Speaking about learning, you brought up a very fundamental point about education, how our education system is structured, and how it remains, for the most part, very colonial. And I remember a few years ago, there was this drive and impetus and urgency, it seemed, to decolonize education. I remember just before the Fees Must Fall movement, we had the Roads Must Fall movement. And that was linked to conversations about decolonizing education. And in many ways, we haven't seen that unfold in practical ways from a policy perspective or from an educational system perspective. So I'm just reveling and thinking about this idea of decolonizing education and what that would entail and what would we teach if we were to do so.
We don't have let's be honest, we don't have a strong policy system in our continent. And I don't understand what our policymakers are doing. These are conversations that are supposed to be engaged with thoroughly in parliaments, engaged mm-hmm. thoroughly in our House of Commons, like our European Union, African Union. Just policymakers need to make proper policies.
Yeah.
You see, the reasons why we are having all of these problems is it's a problem of policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to engage with what works for us. But at the moment, it just feels like our policymakers, they don't really want to engage in policy making per se. Because, I mean, whatever happened with the roads must fall and all of that, we realize that it's not taking effect. Our educational system is deeply European, deeply American. There's nothing that has changed, you know. It needs to change. It needs to. That is an engagement that we need to bring into public scrutiny. We must be open to bring this conversation into public scrutiny, public debates, into public and collect. Again, we are a collectivist society, right? We need to act as one. We need to bring conversation like this into a collectivist engagement, a collectivist debate, and look for a way forward and look for a consensus. But clearly, these are issues that need to be changed, or else we're just going to maintain the status quo. And we'll be happy with that. And again, we look like a laughing stock to other people, to people that are our colonizers. Because clearly, we're just a replica of whatever they've intended to create. And when we make noise of decolonizing, we don't go far. We just enjoy being their replica. Crazy.
Wow. We can end the conversation on that note, because you gave us such a powerful call to action. And maybe, Edmund, maybe we should be policymakers, right? Because clearly, these conversations aren't taking place where they should be.
Should be policymakers. I don't even understand if our policymakers that we have currently, if they even know what policymaking is. We definitely should be policymakers, not the people that we have now as policymakers. Those are brainwashed policymakers.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they make what we call pseudo-policies.
They only perpetuate what currently exists, not changing, you know. But we are seeing some, I would say, positive green shoots. And this is perhaps outside of this conversation about naming, but, you know, on land where we saw the president sign in the land expropriation bill, which obviously has Donald Trump and the Republicans up in arms. So it seems as though in some way, shape or form, we are thinking about these issues, but clearly we need to do so with much more impetus. Edmund, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today and for, you know, challenging us to think more deeply about these important issues. So to our listeners, thank you for joining us for another episode of Read Between the Covers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Infudo, for having me. And thank you to your listeners as well. I hope that, again, like whatever I was saying here, I think that are debatable. I'd like to think that your listeners are critical thinkers. I wouldn't want them to accept what I've said at face values. I know for a fact that your listeners are deep critical thinkers. So we should call for further engagements and debates and all of that. But yeah, I appreciate your listening.
Definitely. Thank you so much.